Just want to offer some reflections. It's the day after Earth Day, and taught a lovely outdoor Earth Day retreat yesterday, and I'm still kind of soaking the goodness of that time in the Redwoods in, and wanted to talk a little bit about how some of the Buddha's most profound teachings are expressed in nature. And as a way of kind of walking us into that topic, just to kind of imagine back in ancient North India, southern Nepal, the Bronze Age, 2.5 millennia ago. And the Buddha's mom was traveling from the palace where she lived with the king back to her family, as was the tradition back then, to give birth. Only apparently she cut the timing a little too close and she didn't make it. So she ended up giving birth to the Buddha to be on the banks of a river in a park named Lumbini. So the Buddha's very first experience of life was exiting the nature of his mother's womb into the nature of this beautiful park. And then some years later, as a young boy, his first experience of meditative happiness, of absorption, happened sitting under a rose apple tree up on a hill overlooking his father's fields and watching people till the fields. So from the very beginning, he was connected with nature. He awakened under a tree, and as the forces of Mara, the life-denying, doubt-filled forces of his sort of personified arch-nemesis, if you will, Mara, were coming to block him from full awakening, he reached down and touched the earth as his witness. And it said that the earth responded by shaking. And then after he became a teacher, he encouraged us practitioners to practice in forests and groves and hills and valleys, all out in nature, the roots of trees. Go practice at the roots of trees, he used to say. He taught his own son, 7-year-old Rahula, was taught to meditate like the earth, like air, like fire, like water, like space, invoking natural elements in that teaching and many, many others, many metaphors and similes over the years of his teachings. So all of this to say that the life cycle of the Buddha unfolded in close connection with the natural world, natural rhythms. And that he used nature itself and the natural world as a source of inspiration. So as I mentioned at the beginning, I'm going to explore kind of a powerful subset of these teachings and how that they are explored through nature or taught through nature. These are gateways to insight, sometimes called the three characteristics, which are inconstancy or anicca, suffering or dukkha, and the confusingly worded not self or anatta. So I'll go into each of these. The first is anicca, inconstancy. Lily De Silva, a Buddhist scholar and translator, talks about how nature is moving, ever-changing, dynamic. Many people have noticed this, scientists and others. And in that sense, it personifies, embodies this principle of inconstancy, impermanence, change. And we can see this even in an urban area, in a park or walking past a tree, the unfolding of a leaf in the spring, a beginning of a bud. And then a day or a week later, you walk by and it's a flower. 2 weeks after that, it might be fully flowered. And then a month later, it might no longer be there, dropped to the earth or the sidewalk. There's the appearance and disappearance of creatures, birds, insects, animals of all kinds. The flow of water, the stream, the unending, scintillating, rhythmic, chaotic, but soothing nature of ocean waves off in the distance towards the horizon. Inconstancy is in the weather, the sky, I mean, it just feels like we've really entered spring in the Bay Area here recently, right? The way the light changes through the day, the way the seasons change, the changing soundscape throughout the day and night. And then there are changes in the tides over the course of a day or a week or a month, ebbing and flowing with the changing phases of the moon, temperature, wind. Wind can be a teacher in of itself. The different contact with the skin, the shifting sensations that can happen. Rising and falling, passing away, flowing. Life seeds, sprouts, grows, blooms, feeds, procreates, fades, falls, returns to compost, engenders nutrients and new life through its very decay and death. This ancient, sacred cycle. A redwood stump, where I was yesterday, there were these, you know, these like, they're called sometimes fairy rings, these rings of redwoods and redwood groves. And often, if it hasn't been too many decades, you can still see the remnants of the mother tree in the middle. Maybe a stump is all that's left. That stump itself is an ecology for thousands, thousands and thousands of tiny little life forms and plants. And until it disintegrates, it receives nutrients from the children trees through the roots, through the fungi, and continues to be alive. But the trees, the redwood trees, are interlinked. Certain kinds of forests are. The roots intermesh, they communicate, they feed each other, support each other. It's this vibrant interdependence, mutuality, reciprocity. We humans don't necessarily do that well at noticing change and constancy. You may have noticed this if it happens too slowly for us, or sometimes if it happens too fast. The changing seasons can feel imperceptible until there's a state change, until we tune in, attune to detail. Paths of rivers, streams change over time. The shapes of mountains. This is very, very hard to see because we don't move or see slowly enough. Spiritual development can be like this. For that matter, any kind of development can be like this. It's possible for growth to happen so gradually, imperceptibly, until there's a shift that's more obvious. Sometimes you can grow and not notice that you've grown larger, more mature, have more capacity, that the outdated perception of oneself doesn't fit anymore until something drops away, something that was maybe constraining unnecessarily. That too is a state change, like a snake shedding its skin. We shed constraining identities, habits that are no longer so useful. But the growth beforehand is where most of the work is happening. It's just hard to notice that. I was reading a blog by Rose Eveleth today, and she was talking about some less common metaphors in nature for these kinds of changes. Maybe you guys are aware of this giant ocean sunfish. It's a huge fish that sort of lays on its side and has one eye. It's kind of goofy looking. It's 4 tons at full growth. It's a massive animal. What I didn't know is it starts its life as a 3-millimeter little kind of minnow tadpole thing swimming through the same ocean. Now, can you imagine the difference in viscosity of the water? Or the resistance of water, this teeny, teeny little fishlet feels that at some point when it grows up to this 4-ton thing, it's not noticing that anymore. It's just kind of floating. It can be like that for us too, in the way we navigate our lives. things that were incredibly noticeable or even challenging can be something that we just float in later, float through. And then, of course, there's the time-honored sort of simile of the caterpillar going into a chrysalis. Completely melts down, shifts into this constant state of flux before reforming and coming out as a butterfly. Which brings me to the second gateway, dukkha, suffering, struggle. Because as it happens, it's not so easy to get out of a chrysalis, or for that matter, a cocoon, which other insects do. It takes struggle. It takes discomfort. It takes effort. And I heard this very poignant story some years ago in a Dharma talk. One of my teachers talked about having known of kids who had a caterpillar farm, and then a bunch of them went into chrysalises. And one of the kids was feeling a little too eager for one of the butterflies to come out. So he tried to help it and cut a little slit for it because it was struggling, right? You could see it. Well, it came out, but it couldn't fly because it turns out that the struggle, the work, is what makes the wings healthy, lubricates them, strengthens them, and lets the creature fly. So nature teaches us about dukkha all the time, right? For something to live, something else has to die. Even something as simple as a plant for herbivores. And on a grander scale, we live because not all of the living creatures that came before us live. The earth would get far too crowded. There wouldn't be enough resources. And there's also the question of eating. Kanisaro Bhikkhu, teaches a kind of pithy, provocative teaching about interdependence, saying that all of ecology intereats. We rely on each other. Which means that total and complete non-harming, that absolutely beautiful bedrock principle of the Dharma, is kind of impossible. Yet the effort of non-harming is what mattered. The intention of walking through life lightly. On a biosphere and ecosystem level, death not only makes room for the living, but it provides compost, minerals, materials for the living. And we have bits of dinosaur material and stardust in our bodies. The oceans flow through our veins. All of it is part of us. This living and dying and joy and sorrow is just in constant flux, and that is nature when it's in balance, when it's working well. There's also the human dukkha, the grief of watching suffering in nature. On a broader scale, and amongst people due to climate change, degradation. This massive reorganization and migration of people and animals happening right now. It's not in the future anymore. All of this is dukkha, and there's an art form to turning towards that suffering with compassion and wisdom. Especially large-scale suffering requires a lot of gentleness and balance and self-care, not to overwhelm ourselves with information, with things we can't control. Part of that self-care, of course, is meditation. And the Buddha recommends putting away grief and distress for the world when sitting to practice formally. I want to underscore that. Underscores putting away grief and distress for the world. It doesn't mean checking out or spiritually bypassing and never experiencing it again. But it means there's a time and a place that it's healthy, it's onward leading to set these things aside and to nourish ourselves, nourish our practice, to flow with this moment, what's wholesome in this moment. And at other points, it's more skillful to allow everything that's happening and meet it with compassion. As Eugene sometimes says, let her rip. Just let it all flow through and meet it. There's an art to acknowledging, even grieving, but not being consumed or subsumed, drowning in dukkha. Instead, it's helpful to see the beneficial actions all around us. I got a beautiful sort of transmission from this, from All Things, from a scientific paper recently. For some related research, I ran across this study that was done based on observers, fishermen, whale watchers, all kinds of like maritime type folks, had been noticing this phenomenon for years that they couldn't quite figure out, which was that whenever killer whales were attacking a prey and they would make a certain sound, if there were any humpback whales in the area, the humpbacks would come and sort of join in the fray. And at first people thought, okay, humpbacks attacking with the killer whales, that's weird. Humpbacks are vegetarian for one thing and have no great love of killer whales. But what people discovered after close observation and what this study documented was that the humpback whales were coming to the rescue of other species who were being attacked. Not even their family, not friends, not part of their pod, not even part of their species, sea lions, seals, you name it. They would come and drive away the predators. They're massive creatures, so they could do it not without cost, but fairly easily and quite reliably. Even across species, there are helpers. I find this inspiring, and find it inspiring too when people are able to focus on the moment, to focus on the moment and offer this kind of compassion, this kind of presence, and this kind of action. I've told this story here before that along a beach, so many miles from the killer whale humpback interactions, this little girl is walking and the beach is covered with starfish. The tide has gone out and the starfish are on the sand. And one by one, she picks them up and chucks them back in the water. One by one. And as the story goes, a man approaches her and says, little girl, what are you doing? Don't you know you can't get them all? You can't rescue them all. And without even looking at him, she leans down, picks up another one, chucks it back into the water, and says it made a difference to that one. And there he was. Octavia Butler writes, there's no single answer that will solve our future problems. There's no magic bullet. Instead, there are thousands of answers at least. You can be one of them if you choose to be. Made a difference to that one. Noticing the difference between drowning in dukkha and making meaning, growing through compassion and engagement, that's a huge difference. And noticing the effect on the awareness itself. Many of you know my day job is as a hospital chaplain. And there's a real art to being able to do that work. There are a lot of arts to being able to do that work, but one of them is in sustaining it. And part of sustaining it is being able to actually notice how meeting difficulty with compassion helps grow the compassion itself. It helps grow a certain kind of very beautiful, elevated kind of mind state. This is another form of letting ourselves and each other be nourished by action, is noticing the effects and finding a way to, it's more than a silver lining, finding a way to take joy in meeting others, in meeting ourselves. If not joy, then love, the compassion itself. This is not cheating. Each of us can become compassion carriers or kindness carriers or mindfulness carriers. And that in itself can be uplifting. It's also helpful in this third gateway to see things in terms of co-arising conditions, a systemic understanding. This is anatta, not self. Another way of putting that insight is no separate, solid, individual self that isn't interconnected. In other words, it's all a play of different conditions, different conditions. This vast interplay of causes and conditions that have come to be and that are flowing onward, they're in constant flux. And this type of systemic understanding, conditionality, can help me pry myself off of a self-centered kind of way of being, or even an other-centered way of being, and instead step back into the bigger picture of what's arising, of what's happening. Watching this relationship in nature can bring deep insight, deep wisdom. And it's easily accessible in a forest, in a storm, in the process of watching animals, plants interact, sitting quietly in a garden for a long period of time, even listening to how the birds interact with each other. Can also be comforting to remember our human place in this vast web of life, this belongingness to the Sangha of all beings. In some sense, that belongingness might be considered another dimension of this third gateway. We belong to the earth, we belong to each other. This is a quote from John Seed's book, Thinking Like a Mountain. He writes, "There and then I knew I was no longer acting on behalf of myself, but on behalf of the earth, my larger self. I knew that I was literally, in some sense, part of the rainforest defending herself." This was his awakening in the midst of activism. Or as Paul Hawkins says, part of humanity's collective immune system. From a Buddhist perspective, Thich Nhat Hanh talks about this from the perspective of the next Buddha, the Buddha to be, Maitreya, being a collective, being the Sangha. The Buddha to be is a collective movement of awakening, he says. So we are integrally part of, seamlessly within and expressing nature, this vast interplay of conditions at any moment. We can notice these deep teachings of the inconstancy, the not clinging, through change, metamorphosis. We can notice how to relate to dukkha. We can notice our place in the wider belongingness of all things. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.